This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger have earned a reputation as the bad boys of environmentalism. Their 2004 essay, The Death of Environmentalism, argued that environmental activism was no longer capable of effectively reducing global warming. They took aim at environmentalists themselves for being, they said, strategically outplayed and for failing to grasp a bigger picture. In their new book, Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility, Schellenberger and Nordhaus continue to make their case for reframing the issues. For instance, they suggest moving away from what they hear as the language of fear about the effects of global warming. They say that just makes Americans worry only about themselves. Instead, they propose engaging in discussions about what both the marketplace and innovation, with some government help, might accomplish. Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger shared their ideas during a talk in mid-February at the City Club of Cleveland. And it's those speeches we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Well, Cleveland was an apt setting. 4 decades ago, the city made headlines when the polluted river there caught fire. And according to conventional history, that was one of the sparks of the environmental movement. But Nordhaus and Schellenberger, who call themselves post-environmentalists, suggest revisiting that history and the assumptions that grew from it. Ted Nordhaus was the first to speak.
Both of us really grew up in the modern environmental movement. Both of our sort of parents were involved in it in one way or another. And, you know, the sort of story that we heard as sort of young environmental activists went something like this. Sometime around 1968, 1969, pollution got so bad that people finally demanded an end to it. Smog in places like Los Angeles was so thick that you could cut it with a knife. Our sort of wild places and wilderness was rapidly disappearing. And then in 1969, the Cuyahoga River here in Cleveland caught fire. And when the rivers catch fire, you know things are really bad. And this led to this extraordinary sort of upwelling of environmental concern in response to these highly visible examples of environmental devastation and pollution. And within a year of this, the first Earth Day has occurred, and 25 million people come out into the street to demand action to deal with environmental pollution, and really within sort of 5 years of that moment, virtually every sort of major environmental law on the U.S., in the U.S., the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, you can kind of keep going down the list, all passed in this remarkable sort of five-year period in response to these sort of new and ever-worsening pollution problems. Well, in researching, going back and sort of looking at this period, we came across Jonathan Adler's just fantastic book and history of the Cuyahoga River fire. And, we read a history that we had never heard, that had been sort of absent from this narrative, this story of the birth of the environmental movement that we had grown up with. It turns out that the Cuyahoga River had actually caught fire multiple times in the previous 60 or 70 years. In fact, industrial river fires in the late 19th and early 20th century were sort of pretty common features on the across the American landscape in industrializing cities across the country. In fact, the very famous image of the Cuyahoga River fire from 1960 that appeared in Time magazine in 1969, that when you go read the sort of histories of folks who were involved in that sort of critical moment, that sort of birth of the modern environmental movement, they talk about, was actually not a picture of the 1969 fire at all. It was, in fact, a picture of a much worse fire that occurred in 1952. And burned for 3 days and caused several million dollars worth of damage. In fact, the 1969 fire only burned for about 15 minutes, caused no damage, and was out so quickly that no one actually was able to take a picture of it, which is why Time magazine had to use the image of the 1952 fire. So similarly, air pollution in American cities was much worse in previous decades than it was in 1969. So if the birth of the environmental movement was not a response to sort of worsening pollution, why did this happen? What was going on? Why in the sort of late 60s did Americans sort of suddenly become much more concerned and politically motivated by these problems? And, you know, we argue in our book that primarily it was a function of affluence and prosperity, that as opposed to the sort of deprivations of the Great Depression in the 30s and the sort of sacrifices during the Second World War, in the years after World War II, there was just an extraordinary expansion of the American economy. Living standards for virtually every American by virtually every standard you could think of improved dramatically for about 25 years and improved literally every year, year in, year out from right after the war through the early 1970s. And, you know, when we look around the world, these conditions, environmentalism as we know it, really tends to kind of come of age and come into being as a sort of powerful political movement under these similar conditions, sort of economic security, economic prosperity, optimism about the future. And as those things happen, people start to become much more concerned about a whole set of kind of quality of life issues. You know, what is the air like? What is the water like? What is the world around me look like? And how am I able, what are the different ways in which I'm able to experience it? And, you know, we sort of make this point in recognizing that ecological concern and addressing ecological problems really is inseparable from creating prosperity, economic growth, and at a global level, most importantly, economic development, which is both, when we look at the climate crisis, is the cause, both the cause and ultimately, we argue, the solution to that crisis. Michael's going to talk about that a little bit later. But I also want to mention how the way in which our journey sort of began here, which is that really back in 2002 and 2003, Michael and I, along with a number of other folks, sort of started thinking about coming out of the environmental movement, looking at global warming particularly as the sort of great sort of ecological crisis of our time, and sort of also looking at the sort of utter inability to sort of address it in the U.S. and really even globally, despite the fact that many nations ratified the Kyoto Accord. Global emissions continue to increase. Even those countries that have ratified Kyoto have made little progress in reducing their emissions. And we sort of started thinking about a different way, both at a policy level and a political level, to start to talk about and think about and address the climate crisis. And we, with a number of other folks, kind of came up with this concept of a new Apollo project. Let's make a huge national commitment and investment in literally jump-starting the transition to a clean energy economy. And rather than sort of primarily focus on regulating our way there, let's really focus on innovating our way there. And, you know, as importantly, really believing that in doing so, we could kind of move the things that we needed to do to address global warming and climate change out of the environmental ghetto, which is a place where everyone says they're concerned about environmental problems, but nobody's very concerned about them. And even today, after an inconvenient truth, and Al Gore has a Nobel Prize and an Oscar, if you just go look at public opinion data, this is a top priority for very few Americans. Meanwhile, when we look at things like the economy, jobs, national security, energy security and energy independence, they're much higher priorities. So we sort of said, how would we kind of take this problem and most importantly the solutions to it and reimagine them as a solution to the things that people already care a lot more about? And that was really the genesis of the new Apollo project. And, you know, so we thought this was a good idea, but we wanted to see if real people, not people who spend all their time sort of thinking about this, thought it was a good idea. So we actually came here to Cleveland, and we did a series of focus groups in Erie, Pennsylvania, just across the border, and then in Akron, Ohio, And literally, it was like the first time I'd ever been to Cleveland, and we flew in both times. So I was back here. I was like, God, you know, the last time I was here, we were doing those Apollo focus groups. And I actually moderated most of those groups. And, you know, what we found was that, you know, we went to Erie, Pennsylvania, because we knew here's this sort of dying industrial city that really has fallen on hard times. And I went in the room and sort of asked people how things were going. And they said to us, if I hadn't stopped them, they would have spent the entire 2 hours sort of talking, just listing off all the plants that had closed and the ways in which that had really just sort of devastated their community. But we didn't let them do that. You know, we sort of got on to sort of describing this new vision of a big investment in America's economic future, kind of getting us off of oil and moving us to a clean energy economy, creating millions of new jobs in the process. And, you know, these folks got very, very excited. And I thought really the kind of critical moment for us was actually towards the end of the group. I often leave and we'll go talk to the folks who are observing it in the back room and sort of, you know, did I forget anything? You want me to ask anything else? But what happens when you leave the room is that the folks who you're talking to, they keep talking with each other. And often it's the most interesting conversation. It's sort of, you know, what they talk about when they're not being supervised by a moderator. And, you know, what they started doing is they actually sort of started speculating about who might be conducting these groups and whether it might be, you know, someone coming to Erie, Pennsylvania to build a new, like, wind manufacturing plant. And, you know, it was a little bit sad because, in fact, you know, we weren't coming to build a manufacturing plant. You know, as much as sort of people are talking a lot more about global warming and climate change and carbon caps and taxes and fees, one of the real failures of sort of where we've come on climate change is we still haven't figured out how to do something about climate change and offer much hope to those folks in Erie, Pennsylvania, hoping to see their local economy and their community revitalized. And really, that was, as we kind of took that message back and we went back to sort of policymakers in Washington, and, you know, we tend to be on the Democratic side of things, so we went and talked to the Kerry campaign and others and leading environmental groups and labor unions, and just grew increasingly frustrated that here was this extraordinary opportunity to kind of bring a vision for a new economy together with a vision for new energy, together with a vision for dealing with climate change, and we kind of couldn't really get anyone to much pay attention or take it seriously. That really was sort of the kind of spark that led us to write our essay, The Death of Environmentalism, which was really about why environmental politics and conceptually the whole sort of philosophical framework for environmentalism was really pretty ill-suited to doing what we needed to do to deal with climate change, where the focus was so much on regulating and limiting pollution, a lesson learned from these earlier battles over things like air and water pollution, that but was not very well suited to what is really a creative and a generative challenge, which is to go literally build, largely from whole cloth, a global clean energy economy. It's a creative enterprise, not a restrictive one.
Ted Nordhaus speaking February 13th at the City Club in Cleveland. He's the co-author of The Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. Following Ted Nordhaus was co-author Michael Schellenberger.
Well, as Ted mentioned, we we both come out of the world of politics, where you want to pay a lot of attention to how does the public think about these issues? How do voters reason about global warming and climate change and energy politics? And we stumbled across a very interesting body of research that was conducted in the year 2000 by it was actually commissioned by the philanthropist Ted Turner, who was the founder of CNN. And he hired a bunch of cognitive scientists, people who study the way that we reason about the world, to do a set of focus groups on global warming. This is, you know, again, 6 years before An Inconvenient Truth came out. And what they did was they would show little TV news clips of various global warming disasters, you know, like hurricanes and floods and tornadoes and water shortages and all sorts of just very scary scenarios. And then they would interview people, and they would kind of be like, well, what did you think of this? And people would say things like, boy, you know, it makes me think I'm going to need a bigger SUV to survive the coming hurricanes. You know, or we better get some land in the countryside that has water on it to survive the collapse of civilization. And it was almost uniformly a survivalist and very individualistic reaction. People didn't say things like, boy, it really makes me think we need those fuel economy standards or a cap and trade system on emissions. And so we were sort of struck by, as Ted mentioned, why is it that with so much data that shows that when you scare people about the future that you get a more conservative reaction, a reaction that really is resistant to change, you know, rather than hope and an optimism where people feel excited about the future, why is it that environmentalists are so focused on this doom and gloom narrative? And we'll sometimes present a whole bunch of the social science research to our friends in the environmental movement, and then inevitably somebody in the back will kind of raise their hand and they'll go, but you know, fear works so well for the conservative movement, you know? And we'll be like, yes, exactly. You know, our book came out last year, and we knew it would be controversial, and so, but we weren't sure what exactly in it would be controversial. It turned out basically everything in it was. But the thing that we really, the argument that we wanted to focus on, that we sort of keep having is really, do we have all the technology we need? Al Gore very famously in An Inconvenient Truth said, we have all the technology we need to deal with this problem. And then the New York Times reporter, a very good reporter, Andy Revkin, sort of challenged him on that. And Al Gore, you know, said, well, okay. He said, we have all the technology we need to get started. You know, and I was sort of joking to Ted earlier. I was like, you know, we have all the technology we need to get started doing light speed travel to the edge of the universe. It doesn't really tell us what we have and what we don't have. And we weren't the only ones that are frustrated by this idea that we have all the technology we need. We just need to set a price for carbon. We just need to make polluting a little bit more expensive. And so we were relieved when there's a little-known body called the International Energy Agency. It's an independent body funded by various governments. Before the Bali meeting on climate change, the United Nations meeting in Bali in December, the IEA, this agency, assembled all the global diplomats in a room, and they did a few-hour presentation. They said, what is it going to really take at a technological level to deal with global warming? They just kind of walked folks through it. And here's what they presented. They said it's going to require 30 new nuclear plants, 17,000 wind turbines, 400 biomass plants, 2 hydroelectric dams the size of the Three Gorges Dam in China. I don't know if you've ever seen photos of this dam. It's pretty, I mean, it makes the Hoover Dam look small. And then 42 coal or natural gas plants that capture the carbon dioxide pollution coming out of the plants and then stores it underground. They said, you'll need to do that every year from 2013 to 2030 to get to 50% reductions in global emissions. So this is not a simple pollution problem that we can just sort of affix catalytic converters to our tailpipes or scrubbers on smokestacks. This is a major challenge. And it really kind of gives you a sense of why energy experts kind of shake their heads and laugh when people sort of talk about the kinds of emissions reductions we need to make, to the point of just being quite cynical that it will ever happen. As Ted mentioned, the idea among most of our friends when we talk about Kyoto is people go, well, Kyoto would have worked great if, you know, if George W. Bush hadn't gotten in the way. Well, the truth is that Europe has ratified Kyoto and has not had great success in reducing their emissions. It's still early, but we can still see some indications that they're going to have a challenge. In fact, from 2000 to 2005, Europe's emissions actually increased at twice the rate of U.S. emissions, at 1% a year instead of 0.5% a year. There are only 2 countries that have actually reduced their emissions substantially, and it's Britain and Germany. They reduced their emissions for reasons that had nothing to do with global warming. Margaret Thatcher broke the coal miners' union, and the United Kingdom moved to natural gas, which is about half as polluting. And the East German economy collapsed after the fall of communism, and when they reunified, they just took a whole bunch of coal-fired power plants offline. And if, in fact, if you take Britain and Germany out of the equation, Europe's emissions actually went up 10% between 1990 and 2005. And not only that, but there's even a more important point here, which relates to the story that Ted was talking about in terms of development and the really close relationship between energy use and development. And that's that when you count the emissions that get created through consumption, if you count the stuff that we consume here in the West, not just the emissions we create by producing things or by heating our buildings or by driving our cars, that in fact Europe's emissions went, or Britain's emissions didn't go down 10% as they would if you just count from 1990 to 2005. They actually went up 20%. And the reason is that we're just buying so much stuff from places like China, which burn a lot of very dirty coal. And so the argument that we make in Breakthrough is that this older model of pollution control is no longer the right model. We don't need a politics of limits so much as we need a politics of possibility, one that's aimed not at constraining human power and potential, but really unleashing it. So if you look at what the Kyoto and the cap and trade regulatory models are based on, they're based on the Global Agreement on Ozone, 1989 Montreal Protocol, the 1990 U.S. Law to regulate acid rain. And those were very successful. We really did a good job on both of those. But it's worth pointing out that in terms of the ozone agreement, we actually had the alternative chemical before that agreement was negotiated. In other words, there was already an inexpensive substitute waiting in the wings. In the case of acid rain, it was a relatively inexpensive fix in terms of attaching scrubbers to smokestacks. So contrast that to global warming, which essentially requires that we just move away from fossil fuels entirely. This obviously raises profound questions about the entire economy, since everything in our economy really requires energy. And the assumption that I mentioned before is that, well, these alternatives exist. They're almost ready to be competitive with fossil fuels. We just got to make fossil fuels cost a little bit more. Well, we've done our own analysis, and many others have done theirs as well, and we found that, for example, to make solar, if you were just to make existing electricity that much more expensive for solar, for example, to become a viable energy source, you'd have to increase the cost of electricity somewhere between 5 and 15 times in the United States. In China, there's a professor at Caltech, Nate Lewis, who estimates that solar is actually something more like 50 times more expensive than coal in China. In fact, in Ted, I'll steal one of Ted's lines from this morning. There's that old fortune cookie game that you play after dinner where you attach the word in bed, you know, after every fortune. Everyone plays this game, right? Ted was like, we ought to just do that game and just do it with every statement that you can make on global warming, add in China to it. Solar is almost as cheap as coal in China. And then you can kind of decide, is that true or not? Some people faulted us. They said, well, you guys didn't say enough about the policy dimension. Because, of course, our book only has three chapters that really deal with global warming. It's really a book about politics and what kind of a politics is going to be required to deal with things like global warming. We talk about healthcare, and we talk about how we make community in different ways. But so we wrote a more technical paper that's available online. It's called Fast, Clean, Cheap. It's published in the Harvard Law and Policy Review this month. And we describe what we think is sort of a Gordian knot, which is that policymakers face. In other words, if you're a policymaker and you want to make existing fossil fuels more expensive to make clean energy relatively cheaper, you could do that, but you'd have to make existing energy so much more expensive than it is right now, that you would have a huge popular backlash against it, not to mention the industry backlash to it. But if you don't make our current energy very much more expensive, then things like solar are never going to become cost competitive. So what do you do with a Gordian knot? Well, in the Greek mythology of it, you don't try to untie it. You don't try to deal with it. That's the wrong way to look at it. You want to cut the Gordian knot. And we suggest that the right model for doing that doesn't come from pollution regulation. It actually comes from technology innovation. So the models that, you know, this is what we mean about the death of environmentalism. We have to stop thinking about this in the environmental paradigm. We have to get beyond the pollution paradigm and look to other models. One of our favorites are the creation of the railroads. This was a federally financed program. It created incredible expansion of the economy in the United States. The highways that Eisenhower justified as a national security concern. In the late 1950s, this is a little story people don't know. We're from California, and people like to think that Silicon Valley was just sort of invented by Bill Hewlett in his garage. You know, no one ever points out that, you know, they wouldn't have ever survived had they not gotten very big contracts for radios. And in the late 50s, the federal government basically guaranteed the market for microchips. Microchips cost about $1,000 a chip in the late 50s, and about 7 years later, after the federal government had just bought so many of them, the price came down to about $20 a chip. We like that model because very similar analogy to solar. Solar also using a silicon chip technology. In fact, both chips now and solar panels are starting to move towards a kind of printing technology. They call it nano technologies. And you find with solar, we have a lot more idea about how the price comes down over time than we did with microchips. We know that every time you double the production of solar panels, the price comes down about 20%. So you can kind of estimate out what would it cost to make solar as cheap as coal. We argue in this paper and in our book that this is the right model. We need to do what we did in the late 50s, not just in terms of buying down the price. We need to invest in the new energy sciences in the same way they invest in the computer sciences, or similar to the way that NIH, which I think Cleveland has benefited enormously from the big increase in spending on medical research, or the internet. You know, it wasn't exactly invented by Al Gore, but it was. But he did a lot to actually bring it from a military application to being commercialized. The internet invented it in a Defense Department laboratory and then eventually commercialized. We actually give Al Gore more credit, I think, for his work commercializing the internet than his work on global warming. We also look to the European Union, where after World War II, the beginnings of the European Union was actually called the European Steel and Coal Community. And it was actually an energy partnership between France and Germany, big investments in coal to make steel to be able to rebuild Europe. And this vision of sort of inventing our way out of crisis obviously has huge appeal for Americans. And the focus groups that Ted described eventually led to us lobbying John Kerry, the presidential candidate at the time. Actually, before he got the nomination, we were in Iowa. We hired a bunch of young students to go and dress up in orange jumpsuits and talk about it, you know, hold up signs for a new Apollo project. And we actually caught it on tape because if we just told you about it, I think you would not believe me, because John Kerry at one point kind of grabs the microphone. He's at some Iowa event, and he goes, "I see there's some kids here from the Apollo Alliance. They've got the right idea. We've got to invent our way out of the crisis." And we're just kind of watching this, and we were like, that guy is charismatic. Like, what happened to John Kerry, and who is inhabiting his body? And it was like literally like that you could just see the sort of the spirit of Apollo had possessed him. And so we were like excited, and then of course as soon as he gets into the general election, it's back to higher fuel economy standards and cap and trade and none of this business of a big investment in the future. And you know, we were frankly a little bit despairing when we started our book tour. We felt like we hadn't really made any progress from 2004. But then, you know, on the first day of our book tour, Barack Obama comes out and announces a very ambitious energy plan that included $150 billion over 10 years for clean energy. That's $150 billion more than John Kerry was talking about. And then Hillary Clinton followed with $150 billion. And so we've been feeling like there's a moment here where people are starting to recognize that the private sector can't do this alone. They're not able to do it alone. They can't make these big risky investments in the future. And I'll just end with a final anecdote about this, which is really a story I think we were telling as much to ourselves as to our colleagues, which was, you know, in the original essay that we wrote in 2004, The Death of Environmentalism, we pointed out that Martin Luther King didn't give the "I Have a Nightmare" speech. You know, that he, you know, sort of there's something in that, you know, that he gave the "I Have a Dream" speech because people had a sense that there was a problem. It wasn't like they needed to be told over and over again the challenge that the country faced. And, you know, we wanted to come back to that story at the beginning of the book, and we, you know, sort of did some more reading about that famous speech. And what we discovered is that King actually did give something like an "I Have a Nightmare" speech. And the setting was the March on Washington, 1963. They were pushing for the famous civil rights legislation that would pass the following year. And King was in a very dark mood. Kennedy had actually called King and asked him to call off the rally. He said, you know, we want success in the Capitol. We want success in the Congress, not a big show on the Mall in Washington. And so King was in a very dark mood, and he had been practicing this dream, sort of riffing on the dream speech in previous talks around the country, and he was traveling with this gospel singer, Mahalia Jackson, really the, probably the greatest gospel singer ever. And he says to her before, you know, she's going to sing before he speaks, he's like, why don't you sing I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned, which is a very dark spiritual. And her manager goes, was like, she's going to have to sing something a little bit more uplifting than that. And King's like, no, that's the song I want. She sings it. He gets up and gives a speech, and you can see it on YouTube. And it's a very dark speech. It's very much about the debt that, you know, white America owes black. America's very angry speech. He's clearly quite fearful that there's that nothing's going to happen in Congress and that Kennedy's not going to be there for him. And he's like, really, you can sort of see it. He's really starting to lose the crowd. It's a very hot day, and you know, he's just getting darker and darker into the dark valley. And then finally, you know, from the back of the dais, Mahalia Jackson just screams out, tell him about the dream, Martin. And you can just, you know, King's a great speaker, so he's very smooth. He can't really detect it, but, you know, he kind of patters a bit. You know, he's a little bit, you know, he hears it, and then she just yells it again, you know, tell him about the dream. And at that moment, King says, really more to himself than anybody else, he just says, but we should not wallow in the valley of despair, and starts to give what we now know of as the I Have a Dream speech. And we wanted to tell that story because we sometimes get accused, well, we get accused of course, being you know, angry and bad boys, but we also get accused of being kind of Pollyanna, and all we just have to tell people about how great the future is going to be. And we wanted to sort of tell that story to say that really you have to do both, that we have to acknowledge the darkness of the current moment. We're in a very awful war in Iraq right now, facing a very serious recession with a lot of expectations that are going to be on whoever the next president is. And we have to articulate a vision of the future that is every bit as bright and positive as the current moment is dark and negative. Thanks very much.
Michael Schellenberger is co-author with Ted Nordhaus of The Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. They spoke February 13th at the City Club of Cleveland, and you're hearing them on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. After that presentation, Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger took questions from the audience.
I find many people are answering the question of environmental problems with nuclear energy. I just wonder what your take was on that.
I mean, I think to start with, you know, Michael and I both come out of the anti-nuclear movement, and, you know, for many years we're sort of strongly anti-nuclear. I think that we, like many folks who've been looking at this problem, including a lot of environmentalists, have sort of started to rethink our opposition to nuclear power. Just when you look at the scale of the problem, when you look at a whole set of concerns about nuclear power, which are quite legitimate, but also, you know, when we talk about sudden and rapid climate change, you know, we're looking at time frames that are in the sort of 100 to 200 year range of just sort of severe societal impacts as a result of climate change. And as Michael mentioned, just the scale of the energy challenge that we are faced with, which is really enormous, we think we probably need to take a serious look at nuclear power again. It's 20% of our electricity generation here in the U.S. is much more than that in other parts of the world. And right now we've got, you know, places like China and India, which, you know, lacking a cost-effective alternative, whether we like it or not, are going to burn an enormous amount of very dirty coal to power their development. You know, that said, I think it's interesting that while, you know, environmental leaders have been sort of saying we need a technology-neutral strategy and all we need is a price for carbon and some good regulations to take care of this problem, the nuclear and coal industries have gone and gotten big investments from the Congress to support the next generation technologies they're going to need to be viable. Carbon capture in the case of coal, and obviously next generation nuclear. And literally, as we have sort of advocated with sort of solar and other renewable technologies, you know, what they've gone is gotten, you know, some guarantee of a market for these next generation technologies to go start to deploy them and in the process improve the performance and drive down the cost. And really, we believe that as much as, you know, we support the idea of establishing some modest price for carbon in the U.S. at the very least, and establishing regulations for greater efficiency and things like that, that we need to make similar kinds of investments in driving down the cost and improving the performance of renewable alternatives, things like wind and solar. And that's not just the actual generation technologies, but that's the infrastructure that we need to support them. We're going to need an entirely new electrical grid. And for intermittent sources of power like solar and wind, we're also going to need major breakthroughs in the capacity to store energy from those, because the sun doesn't shine all the time and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So if you're going to really replace your sort of base electrical generation with those sources, you have got to find a way to store all of that energy, or at least move it very long distances where you can move it from where the wind is blowing to where it's not blowing, which requires an entirely new electrical grid. So all of those things are big technical challenges. I think that whatever, you know, wherever you come out on nuclear power, it's probably going to be some part of the mix in terms of solutions. And if we want other renewables to also be a big part of that mix, we need to be making sort of similar commitments and investments in those technologies as well. So,
appreciate your message. I wanted to comment on your starting out with the Cleveland Cuyahoga River fire. I moved here in 1968 out of graduate school, and my recollection is the bigger environmental thing that I was concerned about was the death of Lake Erie, which I think had been on the front page of one of the national news magazines. There was a sign on the East 72nd Street Wharf, Lake Erie's dead, bury me, or something like that, you know, or a written script. And the other thing I remember is Carl Stokes and his then utilities director put a curtain at Edgewater Park and chlorinated the lake so people could swim in it, so it wouldn't be bacteriologically a problem. And I thought that was a much bigger wake-up call than the fire, frankly. In addition, I'd agree with your analysis to some degree that the economics of prosperity made it possible for people to focus on environmental issues from an economic point of view and an involvement. But I think the motivations were much more save the earth, save our environment, let's live more clean. In that light, I'd like to ask you about two things that weren't mentioned when you were talking about the IEA report, I think it was. Was there any mention in that of conservation and energy efficiency that you just mentioned, and what proportion of the need it could help deal with? And the second thing that a lot of people have talked about is fuel cells as an alternative source. One of the big issues with fuel cells that I'll put right on the table right away is that unless you have a source of hydrogen that's already created in some way, you've got a big issue of energy to create hydrogen, obviously.
Great questions, and I think it's obvious, but you know, we and it's something for those of you that live in Cleveland, is that we really want to tell that Cuyahoga story, not just as a way of saying let's get our own history right, but also as a way to, as a metaphor for really China, you know, for what the developing world is going through. I mean, the other thing that Jonathan's essay, which by the way is a fabulous essay, I think it's available for free online. I actually read about it in a local Cleveland blog the first time. Is that there's also big efforts, way before that. I think in the 30s to deal with cholera. Wasn't there like a cholera? The first sort of quote unquote environmental, if you even call it that, efforts around water were sort of dealing with having, you know, sewage and sanitary systems, which is really where countries often are wanting to invest their resources before they get to those other issues. Conservation and efficiency are obviously a big part of the mix, and I don't know if it was part of the IEA report, but Ted and I recently went back and looked at what is sort of considered the kind of the gold standard report on efficiency and how much it can achieve in the United States. It's something called the Five Labs Study. It was done by five federal agencies, including Oak Ridge. If you just type in Five Labs and efficiency in Google, you'll find it. And what they found is that if you had a price for carbon that was $50 a ton or $14 a ton in carbon dioxide, I don't mean to get too technical here, but basically that's probably the maximum that carbon dioxide, the price that carbon dioxide will achieve under any cap and trade in the United States. Much more likely that it would be lower than that, but that'd be like the maximum that you could probably get out of cap and trade in a positive political environment for that legislation, plus a whole set of efficiency laws that we don't now have on the books. And this is for buildings, industry, and transportation, that what you would get over a 20-year period is an emissions reductions of about 22%. And it just so happens that the time period that they were looking at, this is a model that they were doing, was from 1990 to 2010. So, and what they would found is that if you put implemented these in 1990, by 2010, you'd have reduced emissions 22%, which is almost exactly the amount that emissions would have gone up. So in other words, if you go and do what basically, you go have a price for carbon, you go basically do implement all the efficiency regulations that efficiency advocates want to implement, you'd only get back to 1990 levels. You have to remember that the what people are talking about, what you know, both Obama and Hillary are advocating is 80% reductions below 1990 standards by 2050, a very tall order. And I mean, and we're all for ambitious tall orders, but just to be clear, that would be after we get those efficiency gains. And then your second question was on fuel cells. Yeah, the same. I mean, obviously, hydrogen is not a fuel source. It's a storage technology. I feel like I've seen conflicting stuff. I mean, I at one point just sort of dismissed hydrogen. I thought, you know, because in California they had a really bad plan for hydrogen that they abandoned. But I see other stuff saying that there are some possible usages for it. Ted and I support essentially, a bigger investment in early stage research and development in a portfolio of different technologies. So on that level, we're pretty tech agnostic. We want to make a portfolio of investments. But I will say one thing, which is that, you know, we think that the whole move to plug-in hybrids, you know, they've hacked the Prius now, you can plug it in. And then potentially if you sort of do the electric wiring right, you could power your Prius, drive it home from work, and then power your house from your car battery. That becomes a very interesting possibility because that would increase demand for electricity from the grid, and that might be something that could help drive down the price of renewables.
I'm wondering where the money's going to come from, given the essential, you know, bankrupt nature of our government, federal government, and the finance industry. I'm just wondering who's going to provide the capital investment to completely rebuild the energy infrastructure, and how are we going to do that without creating another bubble of fictitious wealth that's basically characterized the last two periods of economic growth in this country?
Well, I guess a couple things. You know, one is, you know, of course, we don't have the money until, like, the markets crash, and then we find $150 billion out of thin air that apparently, you know, we didn't have. So that's not to say that, you know, we can just sort of start printing the money. But it is worth noting that, you know, when we decide whether it's going to war in Iraq or stimulating the economy, there's no sort of shortage of resources to find. I think a second thing to note is that, you know, at least our position is that sort of a modest, sustainable price for carbon, whether it's through a carbon tax or a cap and trade system with a safety valve, is part of the solution here, so that you do create some market pull to pull these new technologies into the market as you're pushing them and pushing the cost and performance on those technologies in the direction that you need to push them. And a modest carbon tax can generate most of the money that we need, whether it's a carbon tax again or a cap and trade system in which the right to pollute carbon is auctioned. Either of those would generate an enormous amount of money that we think sort of properly ought to be sort of invested back in driving the technology that it will take to actually achieve significant carbon reductions. And it's interesting, if you look at the economic stimulus sort of package, I mean, it's kind of a hair of the dog kind of approach, it really, right now, two-thirds of our economy is consumer spending, largely driven by, much of that over in recent years has largely been driven by sort of unsustainable levels of debt and has sort of driven a whole set of speculative behavior in the economy around the housing market and elsewhere. And, of course, then the solution to, you know, this recession we appear to be in or heading into has been, you know, more of what sort of arguably, if you look at the long-term structural issues in the economy, got us into this situation in the first place. And we think that's a very different kind of approach to the economy than than what we and frankly a lot of other folks have advocated, which is sort of moving us from a nation of debtors to a nation of investors and making sort of big investments in the future of our economy. You know, arguably, we did that over about 30 years with information technology. And I think that's sort of, you know, the one area in terms of the growth of the economy that you can look at and kind of go, that clearly is sort of real and has really kind of created real value in the American economy. And again, our model for clean energy investment is a similar one, that these are clearly going to be sort of huge growing markets over the next century.
Hi, thanks. Very interesting points you're making about striking a hopeful tone. And you remind me of a point the governor from California made in avoiding the negative. And I think he said, don't pick on people who want to drive Humvees. Focus on allowing them to drive those cars they want to drive, but doing so in a better, more environmentally responsible manner. My question is, so turning to cap and trade, which is maybe before Congress this year, how would you talk about that in a way that is hopeful and positive? Because I think you listed it as among still the negative and the limits and the pollution model of environmentalism. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, we think that that it's funny that we sort of are at this place where we're sort of finally agreeing with our environmental colleagues a little bit on policy. It's just for different reasons. You know, we still find our environmental colleagues think that they're going to get to 80% reductions by just lowering that cap every year. And we're highly skeptical that policymakers and regulators are going to just keep driving that cap down if it results in much higher energy prices for consumers. At the same time, money's got to come from somewhere. That's probably a good place for it to come from, since you also get, you know, the efficiency reductions that I mentioned and a whole set of other basically market-based incentives for renewables. We just think we just have to level more directly with the public about it, that the next president would do very well to say, look, we just have to get off of oil once and for all. You know, we've been talking about it for 30 years. You know, our dependence on oil has increased. Our global greenhouse gas emissions have increased. And you know, just as seriously, we are falling behind Japan and Germany and even China in terms of pioneering the new energy markets of the future. They're some of the fastest growing markets in the world are solar and wind. Solar and wind growing about 25% a year. And I think that if you can kind of frame it as this is around energy independence, economic competitiveness, and global warming in that order, and then suggest that it is going to cost us something, we're going to have to pay something for it, it will be slightly higher prices for energy, but it's worth it. We think it's much more likely to have political traction than what may seem like a subtle difference, but we think is quite a profound difference from being global warming is coming, it's going to kill your mama, and you're going to have to pay a lot more in electricity to avoid apocalypse by 2040 or 2012, if you believe the Mayan calendar. So we think that may seem like a subtle difference, but it's actually the crucial one, is it's really leveling with Americans how this is going to happen so that their expectations are aligned and that we're really focused on an agenda of innovation rather than pollution control.
I've really grabbed onto your essay. What I feel challenged by is that I've been called a Pollyanna, I'll level with you. And so I really focus on giving people, using vocabularies of hope, really focusing on the possibilities and what we're moving toward rather than what we're running away from. But people seem really interested in sticking with the doom and gloom and fear, messages of fear and crisis. It seems like people actually I don't think they're that excited or stoked about sustainability, frankly, until I start talking about just, you know, fire raining down from the skies. And then people are like, yeah, and then what's going to happen? And I'm finding, like, I don't believe that long-term behavior change is going to be sustained with fear and crisis. I think it happens when we have something positive to work toward. Yet I'm not finding that on my own campus. Any thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think these sort of apocalyptic visions are very powerful. and they're sort of powerful kind of across the political spectrum and across, for all of us. I mean, you get these sort of terrifying visions. And fear, a couple of things. One is that fear can be a very effective motivator. But I think for fear to then kind of transition into sort of powerful collective future-oriented action, we've got to take people beyond fear and offer some sort of vision of a future they want to be a part of. You know, frankly, I think when we don't do that, we kind of get these, we end up, A, in these very zero-sum discourses. We can't all live like us if we, you know, or the world's going to end. And of course, you know, as much as people talk about their own willingness to sort of make sacrifices, I would suggest that there is a limit to that. And when you actually just sort of do the math, that limit is well short of anything that's going to make much difference in the climate crisis. I would, you know, and we make this argument in our book that we think that where that kind of discourse is ultimately going to take us is a very zero-sum one, where, you know, a whole lot of people, as a lot have already concluded, that there's just sort of not enough room on the sort of lifeboat Earth for all of us, all 7 billion of us. And we think that's going to take, that takes you to ultimately quite a misanthropic place. So we think you got to give people that vision, that sort of place to go. We think we just have to be, you know, that these sort of, the other sort of problem that it takes you to is this sort of kind of weird virtuousness, like I'm more virtuous than you because, you know, I drive a Toyota Prius and you drive a big SUV. But of course, you know, we don't really mention the fact that I fly all over the country while you don't, or that, you know, I drive back to a 4,000 square foot home while you drive back to a trailer. So you get this sort of, you know, where I'm more sort of morally superior to you because I've sort of made myself smaller in some sort of particular ways. And it's not an, again, it doesn't create the kind of, I think, expansive politics that takes us where we need to go. So, you know, our vision, as we said, the nightmare plays an important role. The dream speech is not nearly as impossible without first the nightmare. But if you just stay in the nightmare, it's not going to take us where we need to go.
Ted Nordhaus and Michael Schellenberger, authors of The Death of Environmentalism and, more recently, The Breakthrough, From the Death of Environmentalism to the Politics of Possibility. They spoke in mid-February at the City Club of Cleveland. If you missed part of this hour's program with Schellenberger and Nordhaus, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. When you go there, you can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and join a discussion about this program and previous programs. And in our archives, you may listen to speakers such as Al Gore on global warming, Elizabeth Economy on China's environment, and John Kerry and Newt Gingrich debating whether government or the private sector has the answer to reducing emissions. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.